The Winter Journey, Le Voyage d'Hiver, by Georges Perec. In the last week of August, 1939, as the talk of war invaded Paris, a young literature teacher, Vincent de Grail, was invited to spend a few days at the place outside Le Havre belonging to the parents of one of his colleagues, Denis Berard. The day before his departure, while exploring his host's shelves in search of one of those books one has always promised oneself one would read, but that one will generally only have time to leaf inattentively through beside the fire before going to make up a fourth at bridge, de Grail lit upon a slim volume entitled The Winter Journey, whose author, Hugo Vernier, was quite unknown to him, but whose opening pages made so strong an impression on him that he barely found time to make his excuses to his friends and his parents before going up to his room to read it. The Winter Journey was a sort of narrative written in the first person and set in a semi-imaginary country whose heavy skies, gloomy forests, mild hills and canals transected by greenish locks evoked with an insidious insistence the landscapes of Flanders and the Ardennes. The book was divided into two parts. The first, shorter part, retraced in sibylline terms a journey which had all the appearances of an initiation, whose every stage seemed certainly to have been marked by a failure, and at the end of which the anonymous hero, a man whom everything gave one to suppose was young, arrived beside a lake that was submerged in a thick mist. There a ferryman was waiting for him, who took him to a steep-sided, small island, in the middle of which there rose a tall, gloomy building. Hardly had the young man set foot on the narrow pontoon that afforded the only access to the island when a strange-looking couple appeared. An old man and an old woman, both clad in long black capes, who seemed to rise up out of the fog and who came and placed themselves on either side of him, took him by the shoulders and pressed themselves as tightly as they could against his sides. Welded together almost, they scaled a rock-strewn path, entered the house, climbed a wooden staircase, and came to a chamber. There, as inexplicably as they had appeared, the old people vanished, leaving the young man alone in the middle of the room. It was perfunctorily furnished, a bed covered with a flowery cretonne, a table, a chair. A fire was blazing in the fireplace. On the table a meal had been laid, bean soup, a shoulder of beef. Through the tall window of the room, the young man watched the full moon emerging from the clouds. Then he sat down at the table and began to eat. This solitary supper brought the first part to an end. The second part alone formed nearly 4/5 of the book, and it quickly appeared that the brief narrative preceding it was merely an anecdotal pretext. It was a long confession of an exacerbated lyricism, mixed in with poems, with enigmatic maxims, with blasphemous incantations. Hardly had he begun reading it before Vincent de Grail felt a sense of unease that he found it impossible to define exactly, but which only grew more pronounced as he turned the pages of the volume with an increasingly shaky hand. It was as if the phrases he had in front of him had become suddenly familiar, were starting irresistibly to remind him of something. As if onto each one that he had read there had been imposed, or rather superimposed, the at once precise yet blurred memory of a phrase almost identical to it that he had perhaps already read somewhere else. As if these words, more tender than a caress or more treacherous than a poison, words that were alternately limpid and hermetic, obscene and cordial, dazzling, labyrinthine, endlessly swinging like the frantic needle of a compass between a hallucinated violence and a fabulous serenity, formed the outline of a vague configuration in which could be found, jumbled together, Germain Nouveau and Tristan Corbière, Rambeau and Verhaeren, Charles Cros and Léon Bloy. These were the very authors with whom Vincent de Grael was concerned. For several years he had been working on a thesis on the evolution of French poetry from the Parnassians to the Symbolists. And his first thought was that he might well have chanced to read this book as part of his researches. Then, more likely, that he was the victim of an illusory déjà vu in which, as when the simple taste of a sip of tea suddenly carries you back 30 years to England, a mere trifle had succeeded. A sound, a smell, a gesture. Perhaps the moment's hesitation he had noticed before taking the book off the shelf, where it had been arranged between Verhaeren and Vieillet Graffin. Or else the eager way in which he had perused the opening pages, for the false memory of a previous reading to superimpose himself, and so to disturb his present reading as to render it impossible. Soon, however, doubt was no longer possible, and de Grael had to yield to the evidence. Perhaps his memory was playing tricks on him. Perhaps it was only by chance that Vernier seemed to have borrowed his solitary jackal-haunting stone sepulchres from Catou Mendes. Perhaps it should be put down to a fortuitous convergence, to a parading of influence, a deliberate homage, unconscious copying, willful pastiche, a liking for quotation, a fortunate coincidence. Perhaps expressions such as the flight of time, winter fogs, dim horizon, deep caves, vaporous fountains, uncertain light of the wild undergrowth, should be seen as belonging by right to all poets, so that it was just as normal to meet them in a paragraph by Hugo Vernier as in the stanzas of Jean Maurias. But it was quite impossible not to recognise word for word, or almost, reading at random, in one place a fragment from Rambeau: I readily could see a mosque in place of a factory, a drum school built by angels. Or Mallarmé, the lucid winter, the season of serene art. In another, L'Otriamont. I gazed in a mirror at the mouth bruised by my own volition. Gustave Kahn, let the song expire, my heart weeps. A beast crawls around the brightness. The solemn silence has risen slowly. It frightens the familiar sounds of the shadowy stuff. Or, only slightly modified, Verlaine. In the interminable tedium of the plain, the snow gleamed like sand. The sky was the colour of copper. The train slid without a murmur. Etc. It was 4 o'clock in the morning when de Grael finished reading The Winter Journey. He had pinpointed some 30 borrowings. There were certainly others. Hugo Vernier's book seemed to be nothing more than a prodigious compilation from the poets of the end of the 19th century, a disproportionate cento, a mosaic, almost every piece of which was the work of someone else. But at the same time, as he was struggling to imagine this unknown author who had wanted to extract the very same substance of his own text from the books of others, when he was attempting to picture this admirable and senseless project to himself in its entirety, de Grael felt a wild suspicion arise in him. He had just remembered that in taking the book from the shelf, he had automatically made a note of the date, impelled by the reflex of the young researcher, who never consults a work without remarking the bibliographical details. Perhaps he had made a mistake, but he certainly thought he had read 1864. He checked it, his heart pounding. He had read it correctly. That would mean Vernier had quoted a line of Mallarmé 2 years in advance, had plagiarized Verlaine 10 years before his forgotten Arietta's. Had written some Gustav Kahn nearly a quarter of a century before Kahn did. It would mean that L'Autriamont, Germain Nouveau, Rambo, Corbière, and quite a few others were merely the copyists of an unrecognized poet of genius who, in a single work, had been able to bring together the very substance of which 3 or 4 generations would be feeding off to him. Unless, obviously, the printer's date that appeared on the book were wrong. But de Grail refused to entertain that hypothesis. His discovery was too beautiful, too obvious, too necessary not to be true, and he was already imagining the vertiginous consequences it would provoke. The prodigious scandal that the public revelation of this premonitory anthology would occasion, the extent of the fallout, the enormous doubt that would be cast on all that the critics and literary historians had been imperturbably teaching for years and years. Such was his impatience that, abandoning sleep once and for all, he dashed down to the library to try and find out a little more about this Vernier and his work. He found nothing. The few dictionaries and directories to be found in the Barradas library knew nothing of the existence of Hugo Vernier. Neither Denis nor his parents were able to tell him anything further. The book had been bought at an auction 10 years before, in Honfleur. They had looked through it without paying it much attention. All through the day, with Denis's help, de Grail proceeded to make a systematic examination of the book, going to look up its splintered shards in dozens of anthologies and collections. They found almost 350. Shared among almost 30 authors, the most celebrated along with which the most obscure poets of the fin de siècle, and sometimes even a few prose writers, Léon Bloy, Ernst Hello, seemed to have used The Winter Journey as a Bible from which they had extracted the best of themselves. Bonville, Richepin, Huysmans, Charles Cros, Léon Vallard rubbed shoulders with Mallarmé and Verlaine, and others now fallen into oblivion whose names were Charles de Pomeroy, Hippolyte Vallon, Maurice Rollin, the godson of George Sand, Laprade, Albert Marais, Charles Maurice, or Anthony Vallebrègue. De Grail made a careful note of this list of authors and the source of their borrowings and returned to Paris, fully determined to continue his researches the very next day in the Bibliothèque Nationale. But events did not allow him to. In Paris, his call-up papers were waiting for him. Joining his unit in Compiègne, he found himself, without really having had the time to understand why, in Saint-Jean-de-Luz, passed over into Spain, and from there to England, and only came back to France in 1945. Throughout the war, he had carried his notebook with him, and had miraculously succeeded in not losing it. His researches had obviously not progressed much, but he had made one, for him, capital discovery all the same. In the British Museum, he had been able to consult the Catalogue Général de la Librairie Française and the Bibliographie de la France, and had been able to confirm his tremendous hypothesis. The Winter Journey by Vernier Hugo had indeed been published in 1864 at Valenciennes by Hervé Frère, publishers and booksellers, and had been registered legally like all books published in France, and had been deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale, where it had been given the shelf mark Z87912. Appointed to a teaching post in Beauvais, Vincent de Grail henceforth devoted all his free time to The Winter Journey. Going thoroughly into the private journals and correspondence of most of the poets of the end of the 19th century quickly convinced him that, in his day, Hugo Vernier had known the celebrity he deserved. Notes such as received a letter from Hugo today, or wrote Hugo a long letter, read VH all night, or even Valentin Havercamp's celebrated Hugo alone. Definitely did not refer to Victor Hugo, but to this doomed poet, whose brief oeuvre had apparently inflamed all those who had held it in their hands. Glaring contradictions, which criticism and literary history had never been able to explain, thus found their one logical solution. It was obviously with Hugo Vernier in mind that what they owed to his winter journey that Rimbaud had written, I is another. In L'autre amant, poetry should be made by all and not by one. But the more he established the preponderant place that Hugo Vernier was going to have to occupy in the literary history of late 19th century France, the less was he in a position to furnish tangible proof, for he was never able again to lay his hands on a copy of The Winter Journey. The one that he had consulted had been destroyed, along with the villa, during the bombing of Le Havre. The copy deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale wasn't there when he asked for it. And it was only after the long inquiries that he was able to learn that, in 1926, the book had been sent to a binder who had never received it. All the researches that he had caused to be undertaken by dozens, by hundreds of librarians, archivists, and booksellers proved fruitless, and de Grael soon persuaded himself that the additional 500 copies had been deliberately destroyed by the very people who had been so directly inspired by it. Of Hugo Vernier's life, Vincent de Grael learnt nothing, or next to nothing. An unlooked-for brief mention, unearthed in an obscure Bibliographie des Hommes Remarquables de la France du Nord et de la Belgique, Verviers, 1882, informed him that he had been born in Vimy, Pas-de-Calais, on the 3rd of September, 1836. But the records of the Vimy Registry Office had been burned in 1916, along with duplicate copies lodged in the prefecture in Arras. No death certificate seemed ever to have been made out. For close on 30 years, Vincent de Grael strove in vain to assemble proof of the existence of his poet and of his work. When he died, in the psychiatric hospital in Verviers, a few of his former pupils undertook to sort the vast pile of documents and manuscripts he had left behind. Among them figured a thick register bound in black cloth, whose label bore, carefully and ornamentally inscribed, The Winter Journey. The first 8 pages retraced the history of his fruitless researches. The other 392 pages